Okay, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. A very warm welcome to the Royal Society. My name's Kenny Webster, and I'm the Learning Manager for Birmingham Museums, which includes Think Tank Birmingham Science Museum. And I have the great pleasure of running the Birmingham Café Scientifique in Birmingham. It's an even greater pleasure, though, to be down here in London, here in sort of the mothership, as it were, of British science at the Royal Society. Oh, I've got to announce where the fire exits are. I've just been reading my brief again. If you haven't spotted and you have panicked about what we would do in the situation of a fire, then the fire escape is just over there, clearly labelled. And if the fire alarms do go off, I'm presuming we're not scheduled to have any sort of practice fire escape tonight. Please don't trample on each other as we get out. I think we're relatively safe here in the basement. For the first half of this event, up to the break, there is going to be an audio recording taking place of James as he's doing his talk, but I'm led to believe that after the break, when we're having the sort of the true discussion and the questions, that will not be taking place. So please feel free to be absolutely honest and don't worry about being identified in the subsequent future about anything that you may or may not say. The format is quite simple. James is going to talk for around 15 or 20 minutes, or to be honest, as long as he wants. We'll then stop for a short break before starting up again for a proper discussion. And it's very important during the discussion phase, this is something that we use quite a lot in Birmingham, it's what we call the silly question rule. You know, you're more than welcome to ask a sensible, well-structured question that's pertinent to the events and topics that James raises. But if anybody has a question, I think, I really want to know the answer to this, I'm just too embarrassed, it might sound a bit silly, it might make me sound like I don't know what I'm talking about, please ask it, because inevitably those tend to be the most interesting and thought-provoking questions of the evening. So if you do have such a question, please, you know, dig deep, find that inner courage and share the question with us. Or I have no idea how many of you are friends out there, poke your neighbour and ask them to do it on your behalf. Or if you really can't face it then and you're a Twitter user, please feel free to tweet using the @RoyalSociety handle, and with any luck, David at the back might be able to pick that up, and then he will look ridiculous on your behalf. But I promise you, if you ask one of these questions, you will look like an absolute genius to everybody else, because it will usually cut right to the chase of things. Alternatively, feel free just to like scribble a question down on a piece of paper and throw it at either myself or James, or give it to us in the break, and we will ask it on your behalf. I'm going to stop talking now and remind everybody that the title of tonight's Café Scientifique is What Causes Psychosis? Our speaker today is Dr. James Kirkbride, whose research aims to investigate the social determinants of psychosis with a particular focus on how our social, built and physical environments can affect the risk of psychosis. Please welcome Dr. James Kirkbride.
Thank you very much. You can all hear me okay. I can hear myself, so that's good. So thank you very much for coming along to hear about my research in this rather provocatively titled talk, What Causes Psychosis? Now, I don't want to disappoint too many of you tonight, but I'm not going to give you a definitive list of all the causes of psychosis. I'm afraid that if I could do that, we would be making groundbreaking research in science, in psychiatric epidemiology, and in epidemiology. Because in reality, the causes of psychosis are likely to be multiple, no single cause being necessary or sufficient to lead to disorder on its own, but combining in various ways to increase the risk of developing a psychotic disorder. So what I am going to tell you about this evening is my own research, which I conduct in the Division of Psychiatry at UCL, just up the road. And this research investigates the role of possible social or environmental factors in searching for the causes of psychosis. So I'm an epidemiologist, and one of my main jobs is looking at the association between a risk factor or a set of risk factors and a disease outcome, such as, say, schizophrenia. And then I really want to know, if there's an association, whether or not that association is causal. Does the exposure or the risk factor lead to the disorder? And epidemiologists, they conduct this type of research at the population level. So that means we're primarily concerned with measuring trends in large numbers of people to see where, on average, differences in exposure to those risk factors occur in regard to the later development of disease. So if, as I am, we're interested in the health and well-being of people, we need good measurement of our exposures and of outcomes at the population level. We need really large data sets. We need lots and lots of people and a few fancy statistical techniques. I also need to spend quite a lot of time in solitary dark rooms crunching numbers. So it's really nice to come out here tonight, leave the stats cave, and see all of you interested in my area of research. So my research, as I've said, involves investigating the possible etiological or causal role of social and environmental factors. And I'm particularly interested in understanding how our urban environments may increase our risk of developing psychosis and what aspects of those urban environments that most influence psychotic disorder risk, as well as other roles of factors like migration and ethnic minority status. And I'm going to talk to you a bit more about how those factors influence the risk of developing psychotic disorder in the rest of my talk. But I'll start by briefly defining what we mean by psychosis, what we talk about when we mean psychosis, because I think we all need to be talking about the same ideas in mind. And some of you might know very well what that means, but others of you might be less sure. So I'd like to start there. And I'll mostly be talking about, tonight I'll be mostly talking about a severe set of mental disorders, which are chiefly defined by the experience of bizarre beliefs or thoughts. These are known as delusions. And or by the experience of seeing, hearing, or feeling things which in reality do not exist. And these are, of course, known as hallucinations. We've probably all experienced hallucination at least once in our lives. And don't worry, I'm not going to ask any of you about any drug-taking behavior tonight. Instead, think about when you're going to sleep. How many of you have had the sensation of falling just at the point you're going to sleep? Quick show of hands. Okay. Lots and lots of people. So that's one type of hallucination that we've all experienced. Now, for people who meet criteria for psychotic disorders such as schizophrenia, these hallucinations or delusions are much more serious. They occur in clear consciousness, they persist, and they're often indistinguishable from reality. So the symptoms have to persist for a diagnosis to be made. They're usually very deleterious to people's social, clinical, or cognitive capacities, and they may be accompanied by changes in mood, so changes to depression, or in some cases, episodes of mania as well. And these are the types of disorder that I'm interested in studying and trying to understand what causes those types of disorder. Now, psychotic disorders are really important because they typically strike young people at the very start of their lives, their adult lives. So people are just about to enter the job market, they might be just about to develop social relationships or contribute to society in other ways. Typically, once you have a diagnosis of psychotic disorder, you often need lifelong medication. Some of these medications have quite severe side effects as well. People also who suffer from schizophrenia and other psychotic disorders may have a reduced life expectancy, which is appalling, of up to 10 to 15 years, that of the average person in the UK. So it's worth thinking about that and thinking how much loss of life there is prematurely. And that's not just from the increased risk of suicide, but from worse physical health problems as well as the medications themselves. People who suffer from schizophrenia are also more likely to be socially isolated, less likely to be employed than other people. And while, of course, each case of schizophrenia is a personal and family tragedy, it also has a considerable societal impact. So thinking about the cost to health services and the economy, schizophrenia alone is estimated to cost the UK economy about £12 billion a year in lost productivity and direct healthcare costs. However, with early intervention, treatment, and even perhaps prevention, people can manage their symptoms and lead very full, active lives. So if we could identify some of the environmental causes of these disorders, we can potentially prevent a substantial amount of the psychotic morbidity that we experience in society. Now, of course, we know that genetic factors play a large role in the development of psychotic disorders. Heritability rates are as high as 80%, meaning that if your parent has schizophrenia, there's an 80% risk that you might also experience that. And recent genome-wide association studies show that there are lots and lots of genes which contribute to psychosis risk, but these probably do so by a fairly small amount each. So the increased risk for any single gene is quite small, but putting those together might yield larger risks. But this isn't enough, and we think there's an environmental component in psychosis as well that's very important. And that's something that I'll be investigating in my research, which I'm going to tell you about now. So a lot of my colleagues have shown that there are very strong associations between what I call direct environmental factors experienced by individuals. These are things which include the death of a parent in childhood, various forms of abuse during childhood, as well as things that we think of as less severe, such as bullying. These have all been shown to have an increase one's risk of developing psychotic disorders like schizophrenia. And there's also a well-publicized association between cannabis and schizophrenia. Now, notice I said association, not causation. There's obviously a myriad of reasons why that association might not be causal. But those are factors at the individual level which can be shown to be associated with an increased risk of schizophrenia. But my research addresses two less direct environmental factors and the risk of psychotic disorder, namely living in urban environments and being a member of certain black and minority ethnic groups. And I'm going to take the second of these first. So, scandalously, this amounts to a real modern-day public health tragedy. Certain groups living in the UK, particularly people of black Caribbean and black African descent, are conservatively estimated to have an increased incidence of psychotic disorder. An incidence is the number of new cases in the population per year. They have an increased incidence of between 3 and 5 times the rate for the white British group. And that's after taking into account fairly obvious confounding or alternative explanations, such as age or social class. In work I've conducted in East London, we've also observed that similar excess risks are shown amongst Pakistani and Bangladeshi women, although interestingly not amongst their male counterparts. And these excesses aren't just seen amongst British migrants or British ethnic minority groups. We see raised rates of psychotic disorders amongst Surinamese and Moroccan communities in the Netherlands, amongst black African migrants to Italy and to Israel, to a whole host of migrant groups to Denmark, Sweden, and other Scandinavian countries. But this phenomenon is not even new. It was first observed by a Norwegian psychiatrist named Unulf Udgaard in white Norwegian migrants who had emigrated to Minnesota in the USA in the 1920s and 30s. And yet another psychiatrist, a guy called Benjamin Maltzberg, observed similar patterns amongst all sorts of foreign-born groups to New York State in the 1960s, as well as people who had actually moved internally within the USA, who he found to be at higher risk of developing a psychotic disorder. So the reasons for this excess risk remain hotly debated, and they're part of the focus of my research. We know, for example, that sadly some people from ethnic minority communities tend to experience what we call different pathways to care. They're more often likely to come to the attention of mental health services via judicial routes or via the police than they are through family members or GP referrals. We also know that sadly some minority groups receive worse mental health care when they arrive at services. But having said that, it appears unlikely that these experiences increase the risk of developing increase the excess risk of psychotic disorder in those communities. We've controlled for them, and there's still an excess risk on show. It's also possible that psychiatrists misdiagnose what are normal cultural beliefs, behaviours, or practices, and that these are misdiagnosed as psychotic. But again, in studies that have controlled for this, we can't explain the increased risk seen by ethnic minority groups. So naturally, it's also unlikely that genetic factors account for high rates of psychotic disorders in ethnic minority groups. For example, rates in the country of origin of migrants tend to be comparable to that of the white British group in this country. So this points to something that's largely to do with the experience of migrating or the experience of living as an ethnic minority group in another country. Here we can't rule out the possibility, of course, that genes interact with environmental factors to elevate risk. Now, naturally, this has led to a lot of research which has focused on social factors or conditions which, on average, some ethnic minority groups are more likely to experience. And one extremely curious phenomenon which we've seen in my research is that the exact risk amongst ethnic minority groups is conditional upon the proportion of other people from your own ethnic background who may share similar cultural or shared histories of migration, that when you live in an area with more people from your own ethnic background, your own risk of psychosis appears to fall. Now, this finding is curious because it lends itself to a primarily social explanation, such as the hypothesis that supportive, cohesive communities can ameliorate the experience of social stress and improve people's mental health and well-being. And this is exactly what we see in epidemiological studies. So in further work I've done with Jeremy Coyd at Queen Mary University in East London, we see that in the general population as a whole, when we look at the neighbourhood exposures that affect psychosis risk, neighbourhoods which are more deprived, less equal, and more densely populated have higher rates of psychotic disorder in total, not just amongst ethnic minority groups, but amongst all people living in those neighbourhoods. So the stresses which occur for some people, perhaps isolated from their peers, living in cities which have multiple stimuli and competing demands, may alter the way people perceive their environment, leading to the onset of bizarre thoughts and ideas. Persistent repeated exposure to these adverse social environments, combined perhaps with genetic risk or adversities that we face in childhood, might be enough to lead to the full development of psychotic symptoms and full psychotic disorder. So in some research that I've done in my group at UCL, published earlier this year as part of my Royal Society and Wellcome Trust Fellowship, we've actually seen that certain types of symptoms are more strongly associated with the environment than others. And it's interesting that delusions seem to be more strongly associated with the environment because delusions are partly a response to how we interact with our environment. So what is it about the environment that affects risk, or in the provocative language of the title of this talk, what causes psychosis? Sadly, we still don't know, and it's going to take a lot of combined thinking from epidemiologists, psychiatrists, geneticists, and neuroscientists, amongst others, to unpick the precise pathways through which the environment might lead to deleterious as well as positive changes in the brain. The Division of Psychiatry at UCL, where I work, has many people working in these areas, and part of my role as an epidemiologist is to bring together a body of evidence from different settings using different types of study design in different populations to stress test a hypothesis and build a mountable case for causation. There's also really important unanswered questions that remain, some of which I'll be attempting to explore as part of my fellowship. For example, we don't know exactly when adverse social environments affect risk the most. It could be that prenatal factors are most important, or experiences in childhood, adolescence, or even moving into adulthood. And this is something that we need to focus on and that I'll be doing as part of my fellowship. I've also not talked about another classic issue affecting this branch of psychiatric epidemiology, and that's selection or reverse causation. This is something which Odegaard, the Norwegian psychiatrist, believed, in that people who were to go on to experience psychotic disorders were actually living in worse neighbourhoods, more deprived neighbourhoods, for example, as a consequence of the onset of their disorder. They were perhaps unable to hold down a job, they wanted to be in more socially isolated communities, and so instead of the environment being causal, how much does selection play a part into adverse neighbourhoods? Well, on the one hand, we know that urban birth is associated with schizophrenia risk, so where you're born seems to have a bearing on your risk of schizophrenia 20 to 30 years later. So this points to a causal role. But it could be more complicated than that, and we could see that the selection pressures which force people to move into more and more deprived or unequal communities might apply to the previous generation, to the parents of the offspring who then later go on to develop psychosis. So selection might be very important in our understanding of social and spatial patterning of schizophrenia. And these are some of the issues that I'll be exploring as part of my Royal Society and Wellcome Trust Fellowship, as one of the many enigmatic questions as to what causes psychosis. Thank you very much.
Does anybody have an immediate question or thought that they would like to start with, James? I have thought of a couple of really silly ones, but please, you go ahead, madam. And I'm going to ask James to potentially sort of summarise your question for everybody else through his microphone, if that's okay.
Yes, sure. What sort of measures are you using in your study?
So the question is, what sort of measures am I using in my study? It's a good question, and measurement's something that's hugely important. So the studies I tend to work on involve large population data sets, and we measure individual level risk factors for psychosis that we know, so individual level age, sex, occupation, your parents' occupation, to get a better proxy measure for what might have been going on at that point in when you were born, for example, because people who go on to develop psychosis often have a lower social class than they might have otherwise had because of the disorder itself. So parental occupation is a better measure. We also measure environmental factors, and these are measured in a variety of ways, either by asking people directly about the role of their social neighbourhood, or by measuring aspects of things like deprivation and inequality using things like the Index of Multiple Deprivation in the UK, or a Gini coefficient to estimate inequality. So those are how we measure the exposure and what we call confounder or alternative explanation variables. And we measure psychotic disorder in a very standardized way, where psychiatrists will usually perform a quite robust evaluation using something called a scan. Some of you might be familiar with the scan, to diagnose, according to a set list of criteria, different types of psychotic disorder, or indeed if someone doesn't have an illness. And that's some of the ways we would measure disorder. Okay.
Just as a follow-up to that, and forgive me if this is another silly question, for those that haven't experienced this before, I quite often come up with really silly questions on behalf of everybody. Knowing nothing about psychiatry, this scan that you refer to, I was just wondering, if somebody happened to have delusions, is there the opportunity for them to potentially give different and not real answers based on their own perception of things that you might be asking them?
So that's a very good question. So I should also point out that I'm not a psychiatrist, so I'm an epidemiologist by training. But the scan, it's not a scan like a brain scan. It's called SCAN, but it stands for the Schedules for Clinical Assessment in Neuropsychiatry. And it's a detailed battery of assessments which the psychiatrist will administer to try and tease out some of those issues. So one of the question that you've just asked is about insight, and whether or not someone who's experiencing their first episode or a recurrent episode of psychotic disorder is aware that they have delusional beliefs. And this is obviously important because the psychiatrist has to know whether or not that they have this insight. So it's something that's taken into account in the assessment itself, as far as I understand.
Before we came down, James and I were talking upstairs and we were sharing stories, ones that I'd heard sort of through the media, but real examples that he had of people who were delusional and had experienced delusional thoughts, who then turned out to be absolutely correct, as it were, to have those thoughts. They just didn't know that they were correct. Can you just remind me the one with the drug dealer? I realise I've just completely garbled.
This is a story I heard from colleagues in South London, actually, of someone who sadly had first episode schizophrenia. But one of his delusional beliefs were that the police were monitoring his house with video cameras, tapping his phone and so forth. And this was, he had no evidence for this, which is why it led to the psychiatrist believing that this was a delusion. But a few weeks later, the police busted his house as a drug dealer and arrested him as well for good measure. So assessing whether or not someone has a delusion is this is an extreme example, but it's whether or not there's any basis in reality from their own perspective that they could have come to that conclusion. And often that's not the case. That's an extreme example where it turns out to be true.
Now, I think I saw a hand pop up in this direction. Yes, sir.
How do you explain how these environmental triggers trigger an illness that's so severe? Mm-hmm. I mean, it can be managed in some ways, but quite often it can't. And you know, you're diagnosed at 21, mm-hmm. and your whole life changes.
So the question, if I understand correctly, is how we can measure how severe the illnesses.
You have an in, in, environmental impact
yep.
may not be that severe that triggers something that's right. very, very severe.
Right, I see what you're saying. So I'll rephrase that. The question is how can we know about an environmental exposure which might not be that severe, which leads to the triggering of a disorder which actually is very severe and involves lifelong mental health difficulties? And it's a really good question, and I think it's not going to be any single experience. What we tend to think about in when we're researching this and thinking about these exposures is that it's a cumulative effect of several exposures that's going to likely lead to gradual changes in the way people perceive their environment and the erroneous processing of things which eventually manifest as delusions or hallucinations. And I think we don't know the exact way that those, I don't want to use the word causes, but those exposures combine together. I think it's unlikely to be one single exposure, although we know acute stressors can trigger an episode, but it might be a lifelong exposure to all sorts of different factors like discrimination or low income or factors that affect you in childhood, perhaps even early life infections which alter neurodevelopmental pathways and so forth.
Yeah. Presumably there should be a reverse, some reverse, and there's some environmental places where psychosis doesn't happen.
Yes, there should, and there are rare exceptions of that. I think there's a Hutterite community in the USA which has incredibly low rates of psychotic disorder, and I know there's being research done in that community at the moment as to why that might be the case. Equally, you've got small, isolated, probably genetically isolated pockets of Finland where you see extremely high rates of psychotic disorder. So it's using that natural variation that we see in rates of disorder to try and tease out what environmental or genetic factors might be relevant.
We'll go to the gentleman just over here, and then I'm going to stop for a break. But I've spotted, madam, one question. Can I start with you after the break, madam? Is that okay? And then a question over here as well. But we'll start with you, sir.
What practical measures does your research suggest we should take to sort of negate the environmental effects of psychosis?
So the question is, what practical measures can we take to negate the effects of the environment in thinking about psychosis? And it's a really good question. I would hesitate to give you a definitive answer because of this whole issue of whether an association is a causal association. And we also need to bear in mind that schizophrenia is a very rare disorder. So about 15 new cases of disorder will happen per year in a population of about 100,000 people. So it's quite a rare disorder. So when we think about prevention, we might not have a single factor in the environment that we would say we want to prevent that, because the complexity of the way that those risk factors interact will mean that it's not worth picking out one environmental factor to say let's prevent that and let that all reduce psychosis. What we can do more effectively is look at people who tend to be at high risk of disorder. So whether that's through family risk or through having some of the stronger risk factors for psychosis, and try and manage those people who are sometimes termed as at-risk mental states to prevent their transition to psychosis. So they might have already experienced some sub-threshold symptoms in early adolescence, and it's about managing those people's experiences and providing them care and therapy which tries to prevent the transition into disorder. So we're talking about trying to target high-risk groups rather than apply population-level prevention strategies, which I think we're too far away from. That was a long-winded answer. Did it help?
Okay. Yes. Were you hoping for an answer like, eat more cheese? I think that's always a good thing to do anyway, probably. Just following on from that, though, it's interesting that to have something that is so rare within the wider population, to have what sounds to me to be such a sort of a significant financial cost to the NHS. I mean, yeah. 12 billion sounds like a big number to me. In the scope of the NHS budget, that might be
so
very small.
So 12 billion is a big number. It's not just the NHS cost. It's also the cost of to the economy in terms of lost contributions to employment and so forth. And the reason the number's so high but the incidence rate is so low is because of when people tend to develop schizophrenia for the first time. And that's, as I said, in your early 20s, just at the point where you've had all the investment in you, perhaps for your education and so forth. And that's exactly the point where you might not be able to continue your employment as easily and contribute to society in that way. So that's where I think the high levels of lost indirect costs modelled into the equation, if that makes sense.